I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. With immigration policy and border security on the minds of legislators in Washington, furloughed workers across the country, and immigrants whose status and futures are uncertain, the Senate is preparing to vote on two different bills designed to end the stalemate over the partial government shutdown. Today on Midday, a conversation about immigration with Jose Antonio Vargas. He has lived in the U.S. for more than 25 years. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's made films that have been broadcast nationally. And he has started a nonprofit organization called Define American. And he's done all of this without documentation, making him a legal worker or a legal resident of the United States. His new book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose Antonio Vargas joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The United States is home to an estimated 43 million immigrants, both documented and undocumented. 9 million of them are part of mixed status families, where some people in a household are documented and others are not. Donald Trump made building a wall on the southern border a central tenet of his campaign for the presidency, and he revisited the issue when he stumped for Republicans during the midterm elections last year. As the saying goes, elections matter. But when it comes to restricting legal and illegal immigration, what election matters? The one in 2016 that Mr. Trump won, or the one last year in which voters responded to his border wall postulations by electing 40 new Democrats to the House of Representatives? Mr. Trump is clearly counting on the former electoral interpretation, not the latter, as his insistence on a border wall has led to a partial government shutdown that has created havoc in the lives of federal workers and the people they serve for more than a month. Today on Midday, a conversation about immigration with a journalist and filmmaker who many call the most famous undocumented immigrant in the country. Jose Antonio Vargas won a Pulitzer Prize as part of a team at the Washington Post. He's also written for the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times Magazine, Time Magazine, and the New Yorker. He is the founder of Define American and the author of a new book called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose Antonio Vargas joins me here in Studio A. Welcome. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take your calls and comments a little later in the show. If you'd like to drop us an email, our address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. So let's start by sort of recapping your story, which begins here in the United States in 1993. You were 12 years old, and you were put on an airplane. What happened?
Yes. So I was put on an airplane. My mom told me I was going to America and that she would follow right after. And so I landed at the Los Angeles International Airport in 93. And as I wrote about in the book, I actually thought maybe I was in the wrong country because I thought America would look like Baywatch and Oprah. And then I got And then I got to the airport and it looked like people who look like me, and there were other people that I, you know, growing up in the Philippines, I didn't know what Mexican was. So I actually thought I was maybe in the wrong country, then realized that America was way more than like Baywatch and Oprah. So that was my introduction to kind of American culture, was that day landing at the airport.
You mentioned that if you lived where you lived growing up before your 12th year, there were three primary ways to get to America. Number one, you join the Navy.
Yeah.
Number two, you marry a U.S. citizen. Or number three, you get petitioned by a relative. You did have some relatives here in the United States.
So because of, and people don't realize this, the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act is responsible for why the country looks the way that it does. I mean, it fundamentally shifted the way the country looks. So my grandparents were able to come here because my grandfather was petitioned through the 1965 Immigration Act in 1965. So my grandparents arrived there in the mid-80s. So they were the ones that got me here. Now, I assume that that was the right way. Like, you know, I was 12, so I didn't really know what the right way was or what the wrong way was. But yeah, that's how I got here.
You turned 16, and you wanted to get a driver's license.
As any 16-year-old is, you know, bound to do. So that's, I went to the DMV, tried to get a driver's permit. And that's when I found out at the DMV that the green card that my grandfather had given me was fake. The woman at the DMV said it was fake. When I showed it to her to get the license, to get a permit. And actually, at that time, I didn't know that it was fake. I just assumed that the woman at the DMV was lying. I actually thought she just mistook me for someone who was Mexican because my name is so Hispanic. Because back then, this was in 97, whenever anyone in the radio or the news or anybody said anything about fake papers or quote-unquote illegal people, the media has led us to believe that this was about Mexico. So I assumed that she was wrong, and I assumed that she thought I was just Mexican, which is a horrible way to think. Right? I mean, it was a horrible thing to think about. Oh, you know, I'm not Mexican, so therefore it's not about me. And then, of course, when I got home and confronted my grandfather, he told me that the green card was fake and that I was here illegally and that he couldn't get me here legally because grandparents are not allowed to petition grandkids. It's not considered a close enough of a relationship.
So it's just parents.
It's just parents, not kids, not grandkids. Mm-hmm. And that it was part of this bigger scheme. And so that was when the lying, like all the lies that they had told, started kind of revealing itself. And you know, in the book, actually, as you know, if you've read it, like I structured the book Lying, Passing, and Hiding. So my life in this country in the past 25 years has been consumed by those three kind of stages. And so that was with the beginning of the lying. I kind of understanding all the lies that they had to tell just so I could come here.
When you entered 4 years earlier as a 12-year-old, you also had a passport.
Yeah.
How did you get that? And
so my grandfather,
that was fake too, right?
My grandfather, it was the passport, it was the green card. And then after the green card, figuring out how to get me to work, right? Like how do you work with invalid numbers and invalid papers? So it's this entire kind of underground economy that I basically became a part of. And at the beginning, it was just trying to work with what my grandfather had given me. When I got older, it was not just about what my grandfather did. I had to make choices, right? And so his lies kind of became my lies. I wasn't just, quote unquote, the victim as I was as a 12-year-old because I didn't know any better. I knew better. And the only way to kind of keep going was to keep lying and to keep, you know, breaking laws. So that's what I did.
You ended up going to college. I want to play a clip of a young woman from California who's also a college student. Her name is Jimena Sanchez Martinez.
I would say that it was when I started looking for scholarships for college. I started to realize that I couldn't apply to most of them because they require some citizenship status. And that's kind of what started to make me question what I was doing, like with my academics. And then, but it, reflecting on that, it helped me realize that what I was doing was not in vain. And it empowered me because it gave me, it inspired me to work harder so that I can take advantage of whatever opportunity came by. I would like to be a chemist or a doctor and come back to my community to inspire more girls to go into STEM and just show that papers won't define who they are.
And that's a young lady who you've put on your Define American website. Mm-hmm. You had a similar situation. You wanted to go to college, needed some scholarship money to do that. And again, as an undocumented person, that was complicated.
Yeah, and this was in the early, 2000 when actually when I went to college the first year, there wasn't a DREAM Act yet. That wasn't part of the conversation. And at the time, there was really no language around this. You know, I just was lucky that I went to a high school where I was supported by so many of the parents and the teachers. And so they were the ones that figured out how to get me a scholarship in which immigration status wasn't an issue.
Now, is that because the policy of that particular school, you went to San Francisco State?
I went to San Francisco State. And the only reason I went to San Francisco State actually was because it was a school where if your GPA was higher than a 3.0, you didn't need an SAT score. And since I was a kid, you know, when I found out I was here illegally, who cares about taking the SATs? You know, like college was not an option. So I didn't even take the SATs. So thankfully, my GPA was, I think, 3.1 or 3.2. So I was able to go in without having an SAT score.
And you pursued a career in journalism, which worked out quite well. I mean, you worked for some very, you know, really prestigious publications, including San Francisco Chronicle, The Washington Post. When you applied for a job at The Washington Post, what did you tell them? What did they ask you about your, you know, citizenship status? And what did you tell them?
So that's when, you know, when I was younger and my grandfather said, well, you got to go work. We went to a Kinko's, the, you know, FedEx Kinko's, and we took the passport that he gave me to get a social security number, which wasn't supposed to be used for work. It says clearly not valid for work authorization, without authorization. And my grandfather took like a piece of white tape and cut it and covered that thing that said not valid for work. And then we made like 10 copies of it. I remember that we made like 10 copies because, you know, every copy was like 10 cents or something. And my grandfather was a frugal man and he didn't want to make more than 10 copies. I don't remember that. He didn't want to make more than 10 copies. And that's the photocopied social security number that I gave the Washington Post. I only always just gave photocopies because I could never show the original. Thankfully, each time I did that, I managed to pass, you know, meaning they didn't ask for more, which is why a big part of my life has been, how do I exist here without people wondering if I'm not from here, right? And so for me, that meant appearing, sounding like, acting like I was American so that no one could question that it was a photocopied social security number. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of those little things that you kind of imagine yourself thinking.
I mean, you and millions of other people.
Millions of other people.
Have jobs, file income taxes.
File income taxes.
Pay money into Social Security on these bogus numbers with no hope of ever claiming any of that Social Security number when you're in your 70s or whatever.
I'll never forget when I was at the Washington Post, you know, when I started paying the taxes, you know, paying income taxes, right? And then, of course, state taxes. And being in D.C., I remember, you know, in D.C., the license plates, taxation without representation. And I remember that took like an even more complicated meaning for me. Like, I went to the H&R Block one year to do my taxes, and there was this man who was helping me out because it was kind of a confusing process for me, as for many other people, documented or undocumented. And at one point, I wanted to kind of blurt out to this guy, Mike, who was helping me prepare my taxes, that I was undocumented. Stop myself, say like, don't complicate this, just pay the taxes and shut the hell up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that was the conversation, right? Pay the taxes, pay the Social Security, even though you don't get it back, and just shut up. Don't say anything, put your head down, just be happy that they haven't caught you, and just keep going.
But you changed your mind about that.
I changed my
mind.
In
2011, you turned 30, you had been able to get a driver's license because the state of Oregon.
At that time, Oregon was one of only two states that had requirements that were lenient enough that undocumented immigrants could go get a license.
You didn't live in Oregon.
Nope.
But you were able to get a license through the state of Oregon. But in 2011, you decided not just to tell Mike at the H&R Block office, but the whole world in a magazine piece in the New York Times Magazine that you were undocumented. You came out very publicly. Why did you do that at that point? Your license was expiring.
So that was actually the practical reason, right? Like people, and I actually really want to underscore this. That's why the term undocumented to me is the most accurate, because it means that your life is dictated by these documents, right? That were illegal, unauthorized, whatever the term is. So my only piece of ID was that driver's license. If I didn't have the driver's license, I was covering the 2008 presidential campaign. I was like covering Sarah Palin. I was on Hillary Clinton's campaign plane in Ohio in 2008. So without that license, I could not have had a career. And it was expiring after eight years. And I had to make up my mind whether or not to continue lying, which I could have done, right? Or one option was to leave, right? Clearly, I didn't do that. But at the time, it felt like the most obvious option, because really I was afraid that I had spent so much time kind of tending to my career as a journalist. And I knew that the moment I said that I was undocumented, I knew that I was throwing my career, you know, with the way how newsrooms work and how you're not supposed to, you know, especially if you're not, you know, if you're a person of color, if you're someone who's not, whose identity is seen as having an agenda. I knew that the moment I said that I was undocumented, I would be suspect, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. You had a lawyer tell you that it was legal suicide.
It was legal suicide.
But you also write that it was less about coming out and more about letting people in. So it is legally, you are, as we speak, sitting here, you are in legal jeopardy right this second, right?
As are millions of other people who have no protection whatsoever from the law that we did not that we did not create, and in many ways don't, you know, the American public don't really understand, to the point that we've shut down a government partially because of it.
So when you say it's about, it's less about your coming out and more about letting people in, what do you mean by that?
I mean, and I'm also saying this as someone who's gay, I think this idea that we come out, right, it's out to you. This is my life. You know what I mean? So it's kind of taking agency and taking ownership of my own life, right? And the fact that sharing your story in whatever way you do it is a way of getting people to see the humanity of whatever the issue is or whatever the struggle that you're grappling with, and making it about, taking it outside of this minority othered kind of prism in which I, you know, as if all we do is explain ourselves to people, right? As if we're lab experiments that have to be dissected and explored, other than human beings who are trying to live our lives the fullest we can.
Jose Antonio Vargas, the new book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. He's speaking at the Church of the Redeemer in Baltimore tonight, and he's my guest for the hour today here on Midday. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, you are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow is our quest for health and svelte bodies destroying the planet. The challenge of eating a diet that is both good for individuals and sustainable for the earth writ large. Monica Reinagle, the nutrition diva, joins me for Smart Nutrition. Plus, speaking of nutrition, Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore. That's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, my guest is the journalist, filmmaker, and activist Jose Antonio Vargas. We're talking about his new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Immigrant. You're welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. I want to ask you to respond to the very basic question that so many people raise, which is essentially, we are a country of laws, and why should we selectively enforce some laws and not enforce others? I want to play a little clip from a man named David Ward. He is a former official with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. This is from a video that you actually provide commentary to. It's produced by the Marshall Project.
Our immigration law is continually being exploited by people that just can't follow the law. We like law-abiding people. We like people that contribute to the fabric of this country, enhance our culture, to, you know, just make this melting pot even greater. But when you don't have the integrity, and that you're going to lie and cheat to do whatever you can to get into this country, my sympathy level is not very high.
Mr. Ward isn't the only person whose sympathy level isn't very high. Yeah. What do you say?
You know, I actually, when I was watching these videos, which I really implore, if you want to check out, go to the Marshall Project online, and these
we're gonna link to it on our website.
They're pretty extraordinary, and what I liked is the videos are in conversation with each other, right? Which is something that we as a society are not willing to have. I wonder if Mr. Ward himself are watching all the other videos that are part of the series. I hope he does. So let's talk about integrity. So have I broken laws? Yes, I have. And mind you, this is why I thought it was important that I come forward and voluntarily do what I'm doing. If it was up to immigration lawyers, I would not even be speaking to you. There would be no book, there would be no Define American, and there would be no organization, right? Because the lawyers are like, the moment you say this publicly, the moment you admit to everything you have done to stay here, we can't help you. But even though these laws are something that I've been grappling with since I was a kid, I thought my first obligation was to expose them so people understand why people do what they have to do, right? So that's what integrity means to me. And so when people like Mr. Ward say that, you know, people like, you know, that he would be supportive of people who are contributing members of society, I would argue that I've been contributing to this country. If taxes is one form of it, although to me it is one, but that's just one form. I would argue that the work that I've done, how I am as a person, my responsibility to my community, to the places that I have been a part of in this country, I would argue that I have been a contributing member of society. Now, as for breaking laws, I don't think there's any person you would ask today that would willingly and would deliberately want to break laws, right? People are put into circumstances, and when you're facing these circumstances, you have to make a choice. Like, for example, you know, as I detailed in the book without my lawyers knowing about it until after I had written it, the first time I actually lied on a form, on an employment form, was when I was getting a job at the Chronicle, at the San Francisco Chronicle. And, you know, when you get an employment form, you have to check a box, right? It says, are you a U.S. citizen? Are you a resident alien? Are you a resident alien willing to work? Three boxes. I had to sit there, and this was in 2000. So there were no iPhones. So I couldn't, like, Google perjury. Like, you know, when it, like, outlined what it means to check the box. I had to make a decision what box I was going to check. And if I wanted to work and pay taxes and be a contributing member of society, it was very clear that there was only one box to check, the citizen box, even though I'm not, right? And it said very clearly there that it was against the law to lie on the form. So I had to make a decision. Do I lie on the form and work and pay taxes? Or do I not say anything at all? Do I not work? Do I just kind of be a part of this underground economy and work under the table jobs, right? I went the other way, right? And that's a choice that I have to live with. And the consequences of that is something that I'm living with right now, right?
Do you make a distinction between your individual case and the case, for example, of asylum seekers who are coming from Central America, who are fleeing abuse, they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing gangs, they're fleeing, you know, a horrible situation? I mean, your mom and you your mother made a very difficult decision. 12 years old, yep. She gets rid of her son. I mean, you have not seen her. I mean, I don't know if that's the way to say it, but
yeah,
she voluntarily separates herself from her child.
Even the phrase you use, get rid of her, because that's what I thought when I was younger. I thought maybe I was a complication. Maybe I thought that she didn't really want to be a mother. Maybe I was too much of a responsibility.
But now you understand that she was hoping now you would have the opportunity, yes, that is afforded people who live here.
But to your original point, absolutely, there's a legal distinction between people who are claiming asylum. I mean, legally speaking, technically speaking, there are absolutely distinctions, right? And that is now what we see in America circa 2019. Now, what was that 100 years ago? when there was no border patrol, when there was no visa process, when there were no green cards, when there was no right way to come to America. People just came. And all the people listening right now who are saying, well, back then, you know, the country wasn't so overpopulated. I don't know about you. I've been to Idaho. Have you been to Idaho?
Once.
We're not overpopulated.
No, not at all.
We need
If anybody
in
who's
Montana,
ever flown from New York
people.
To LA knows,
so please,
this is a very unpopulated
please bear
country.
Me that. Yeah. Like, I've been everywhere in America,
yeah,
and I can
room.
Tell you right now
yeah.
that there is room. It's just a matter of who do we want to come and why do we want them to come. However, I think what's important, and I'm glad that we're actually discussing this, is for us to interrogate why people are coming to begin with. Like, what are the actual, you know, root causes of migration, right? And I think that's something that we in the news media have to do a much better job actually investigating. And I think the public has to better understand and connect with their own histories why people come here to begin with. And it, to me, it's way more complex than saying people want a better life, right? The reality is, the United States, when it comes to foreign policies and economic policies, there are many things that we have done as a country that have led to all to other people from other parts of the country wanting to come to America.
Do you then think that people talk about this as a matter of fairness? So there are people who would say, okay, you're a contributing guy, you've paid your taxes, you've contributed to Social Security, you've done really great work as a journalist. However, the law is the law. If the law were different, maybe your circumstances would be different. But under the current law, you need to leave the country and go back to the end of the line and apply for American citizenship under the current law. It's not fair for you to jump ahead of those people who are going through the so-called
line,
the legal process of becoming of either getting a green card and eventually becoming a citizen.
So, and to me, that's a really, really important point to make, given that there is no legal process for someone like me to follow. If there was a legal process, I would be following the legal process right now and not talking to you about it.
So why right? isn't there a legal process? There
why
is no way
there,
for you to apply no for way. A green card in the United States?
As it currently stands, especially considering the fact that we've shut down the government partially because of immigration, there is no legal process for millions of undocumented immigrants to legalize their status and normalize their status. There is no such line. It does not exist. Most of the conversation right now have revolved on people who are DACA recipients, people who have the temporary status, which is an important issue. People right now with temporary protected status, TPS, that's another issue that's being discussed. But for the most part, we still have not been able to talk about, you know, people say it's 11 million undocumented immigrants. I don't know. If I were to count all the undocumented white immigrants that I've met in the past 7 years, I would venture that it's way more than 11 million people.
But your options for, as we say, getting on the line for legal immigration were actually compromised the minute you entered the country with a false passport, right? In other words, there are people currently outside of the United States who do have a process.
My mother.
There are like your mom.
Who's been waiting for 16 years to come.
It's a long process.
Long process.
But because you have knowingly and now and as an adult, you know, made the decision to willfully lie on forms, et cetera.
Absolutely.
So that compromises you. So,
but then when people say breaking the law, I think trying to understand that these laws have been constructed and created, you know, like there was a part in the book when I had to really deal with, you know how we like to say that we have a broken immigration system? When I was detained in Texas a few years ago now, I had to, because, you know, when you're detained, all I had to do was.
And you're detained by immigration authorities in McAllen, Texas.
In McAllen, Texas,
right
at the border. Mm-hmm. And it was really the first time in my life that I didn't have anything to distract myself with. Like, there was no, you know, I'm the kind of person that the busier I am, the better. So therefore, I don't have to go think about my life and how crazy it is. So there was no distraction. I was in a jail cell. There was nothing to look about myself. And I'm sitting in the jail cell and I'm thinking to myself, this is not broken. This is deliberate. I came to the conclusion that if we just took one slice of this whole issue, the fact that we say, right, that we say that we wave a flag outside of the U.S.-Mexico border saying keep out, out. And then 10 yards in, we say what? Help wanted, right? The fact that since the amnesty program that Reagan enacted in the 80s, part of what made that not successful was there was really no incentive to deal with employers who kept employing undocumented immigrants. I mean, there are entire industries in this country, entire states in this country would collapse without undocumented labor. So if we're not really dealing with employers, if we're not dealing with the underground economy that this has created, then what are we really doing?
Yeah. People talk about so-called merit-based immigration. I want to play a clip from Tucker Carlson. He's a host on Fox News, and you've appeared on his show. This is from a show that you were not on. This is the New Year's Eve edition of the Tucker Carlson show, in which he had this to say.
People debate all the time about mass immigration. What you never hear anybody do is make the economic case for mass immigration. And here's why. Our country's economy is becoming more automated and tech-centered by the day. It's obvious that we need more scientists and skilled engineers, but that's not what we're getting. Instead, we're getting waves of people with high school educations or less. Nice people, no one doubts that, but as an economic matter, this is insane. It's indefensible, so nobody even tries to defend it. Instead, our leaders demand that you shut up and accept this. We have a moral obligation to admit the world's poor, they tell us, even if it makes our own country poorer and dirtier and more divided. Immigration is a form of atonement. Previous leaders of our country committed sins. We must pay for those sins by welcoming an endless chain of migrant caravans.
That is hideous.
Oh,
that is hideous,
Tucker, and Tucker, Tucker,
it is
Tucker,
hideous
Tucker.
And intellectually vacuous on so many different
Thank
levels.
Thank you. What was the phrase? Intellectually vacuous.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing to say that nobody is talking about it is ridiculous. This is the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed by Neil Kashkari, who is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He writes early in 2018, long-term economic growth comes from two sources: productivity growth and population growth. Population growth drives economic growth because a larger population means more workers to produce things. So it's not just about scientists. It's about people working all up and down the economy. To call immigration a cause for making the America poorer and dirtier is just racist and hideous on its face. But the arguments that Mr. Trump and others are making about so-called merit-based immigration, when you make the point that, look, I've been here for more than 25 years and I've been contributing, I've done work that's valuable, I've paid my taxes, etc. Is that in a way sort of buying into this merit-based argument of that people on that side of the debate make?
Well, first of all, I think one of the, probably for me, the most insidious part of the Trump administration, and there are many, many parts, is that it's very clear in their rhetoric and the policy decisions that they have made and that they want to continue to make that this is actually not about legal or illegal immigration. They just don't want people here. They just don't want a certain kind of people here, right?
And there is, in fact, an economic argument for having a lot more people here.
Exactly, right? So there's that. And for me, in the beginning, that was one of the things that I had to really grapple with, because I knew that the moment I came out, people would project onto me this good immigrant, model minority, even kind of elitist status, given the work that I was doing, right? That I wasn't the typical, quote unquote, undocumented immigrant, or that I'm too educated. Some people actually said that to me. Yeah, you know, you're actually not a good poster child for this issue because you're a little too educated. People are not going to see. People are not going to think that you represent the kind of people that you think you represent. And for a while, I actually internalized that. I actually surrendered to that thinking, you know, maybe I'm not the right kind. And then I came to the conclusion that there is no right kind. I'm just one person. Right? I'm just one story.
And you are telling that story in a really fascinating and provocative book. It's called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. We'll have more with Jose Antonio Vargas. His new book is the topic that he'll be speaking on tonight at the Church of the Redeemer. It's part of the Writers Live series at the Enoch Pratt Library, and he'll be back with us here on midday after a short break, and we will get to Clarence and Bill, who are on the phone. If you'd like to join us, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet, and we will be right back. Welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Jose Antonio Vargas. In his new book, he reports that between 1965 and 2015, new immigrants and their offspring accounted for 55% of U.S. population growth. In the next 50 years, immigrants are expected to comprise 88% of our population growth. So to put the rate of change in our country's demographics into sharp relief, Vargas notes that in the first 187 years of our republic, about 42 million immigrants came to the United States. Since 1965, 43 million immigrants have come to our shores for a variety of reasons, changing the American landscape in a variety of ways. So 43 million since 1965, and we had 42 million in the first 187 years of the Republic. Jose Antonio Vargas came to America at the age of 12. He arrived on an airplane from the Philippines with a fake passport. In 2011, after living here for 18 years, he outed himself in the New York Times Magazine as undocumented. He remains undocumented to this day. His book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to Bill in Baltimore. Bill, welcome to Midday with Jose Antonio Vargas.
Hi. How are you, gentlemen, doing today?
We're doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, first off, let me just say this. All of us, except for American Indians, are immigrants. But we went through a process. You know, that I just want to get that out there. But the real reason I called was this. I haven't heard anybody in any conversation talk about the people who are hurt by their Social Security number being used and they're not deceased.
All right, let's have Jose Antonio Vargas address that. Thank you for that call,
Bill. That's a totally valid point, and you're right.
So in other words, people who steal Social Security numbers.
Yes, from people who are still alive and kind of how that impacts that person's life. You're absolutely right that that's a part of this issue that has not gotten reported as much as it should be. I'm actually working on something on that, but that's going to take a few more months to figure
project,
out.
Right.
Yeah, a journalism project that tries to figure that out, because I was curious about that as well. In addition to that, part of this entire kind of system, I mean, we have in this country, you know, I mean, I remember when I first found out about ITIN numbers, ITIN, individual tax ID number. So that was established in the mid-90s during the Clinton administration, and that allows undocumented immigrants to pay taxes to the government. So wait a second. So while you have an entire system that detains and deport us, you also have an entire system that wants us to keep paying these taxes. So I remember thinking to myself,
and a way to do it. So you don't have to steal a Social Security number. You can use an individual tax ID.
Are they talking to each other? Mm-hmm. Are these governmental agencies actually talking to each other? The other point I want to make, because the caller made this point, it was Bill, right? A couple of important clarifications, because I think it's really important that when we say this, we actually acknowledge the fact that unless you're Native American or African American, right? I mean, slaves were not immigrants. They did not choose to come to America. So I think that's a really important distinction to make, especially because we're in Baltimore. I think it's important that we kind of that whenever we say that we are a country of immigrants, that we acknowledge the fact that Native Americans and African Americans are the two groups of people who are not a part of that equation, right? The third thing, because he made a point to call it a process. So what was the process? I remember when I was on Bill O'Reilly's show, when he still had a show a few years ago, and he said that, you know, his great grandparents did it the right way. What was the right way? What was the right process? This is where I think our country, this is where I really applaud history teachers out there. And I would hope that this is a time where if you're a teacher and you're teaching U.S. history, I would sincerely hope that you are telling our history as fully and as complex as you possibly can, so that people understand just all these narratives that we've told ourselves.
Yeah. And of course, the way, whether it was right or wrong, was different before 1965.
Absolutely.
It was different in 1986. It was different. It's different now.
In 1890, given, and 1850.
So the notion is, you know, what should the right way be? And that is an argument that's been, you know, looming in Congress for a long time. And it's one that there's very little consensus on. Which is an interesting thing. So I want to talk about that. But first, I want to take a call from Clarence from New Freedom, Pennsylvania. We're always happy to hear from Clarence. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Look, I'd like to commend your guest, what he's doing. It's a few things here, and I'll take my answers off air. One, process. I have friends that come from African countries, and they've been in the quote-unquote process for 16, 17 years. Now, is this because of the visas that they have or what other thing? I think that the government chooses. Recently, we had Donald Trump's in-laws. How did they get in the process so fast and were deemed now their citizens? During the campaign, Melania was supposed to give proof of her citizenship, which never came. And in 1969, we had a group that was in El Salvador. And for years, these people have been coming from these countries because of civil war. And it just doesn't make any sense. If you have a process, then it should be, okay, the process is going to be 5 years. But yet these people are working, they're taking taxes, and I don't care whether it's illegal or whatever. You need to have a process. You need to give them a chance. They want to come here. Here's a gentleman that has worked, and he's proved himself. But yet the process, as they say, wants to put him out. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thanks for that call, Clarence. You write, Jose Antonio Vargas, that you can't change the politics of immigration until you change the culture in which immigrants are seen. Is that, in fact, going to be a prerequisite for any movement on what people like to refer to as comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, first of all, I don't know what comprehensive immigration reform is. I don't know what that looks like at a time when people are not even on the same page about what the issue is, and at a time when, you know, the concept of compromise is so, I don't even know where that is, right? And I'm saying that as someone who I've been everywhere in this country. You know, I've subjected myself to make sure that I'm talking to everyone who don't agree with me, to try to understand where can we meet? Like, where do we actually can figure out what is the solution to this? Like, what does the center look like? And the center and compromise is not anywhere near this conversation. When I talk about changing culture, I mean, this morning, I don't know about you, but when I wake up, I just try really hard not to look at the president's tweets. But then it just, you can't escape it. And then this morning he said, build the wall and crime will go down, right? And this marrying again of this idea that immigrants are here committing crime, when there's absolutely no fact that backs that up. And then Clay Shirky, who was someone who I called when I was a reporter at the Post, he was a source of mine. He had this phrase right after the election. He said, you know, that facts are, you know, this is not just about facts. You don't win a culture war with facts. The reality is we are in the middle of a culture war, one that this president has shaped from the very beginning. You know, I don't think it's any surprise that here we are when the government is partly shut down over a wall, when this is precisely what he said when he said he was going to run for president in 2015, right? This was the issue that he was going to grapple with. And I think that if we are to actually have a conversation about what the issue is, we have to, first of all, deal with not only the facts of the issue, but the subtext of the issue. Tom, I was really glad that you were quoting what I said there about just the pure numbers of what we're dealing with, right? This country, what, 42 million immigrants in 187 years, most of them, right, from Europe. So most of them becoming white, whatever white means. And then now you have 43 million immigrants, mostly coming from Latin America, Asia, and many from Africa and the Caribbean, who are not coming from Europe. Like, that is the subtext to all of this. This idea that, what is this country becoming? Who are we becoming? That is a cultural conversation that has to happen in communities across the country. Yeah. Immigration reform is not going to solve that.
And by the way, according to census data, more than 43% of African immigrants hold a bachelor's degree or higher. People from Nigeria are particularly well-educated, much higher than Chinese or South Korean immigrants. African immigrants are also very likely to hold advanced degrees, many of which are earned here in the U.S. Mr. Trump does couple immigration with crime. There's so much data that says that that's exactly the opposite is true, that in fact immigrants are considerably less likely to commit crime than so-called native-born Americans. People also bring up the fact that undocumented immigrants exploit and cost the United States government money because of the services that they are availing themselves of. Social Security Administration says that there is a net positive financial effect of $12 billion having to do with what it costs to provide services to undocumented people and what they contribute in terms of taxes and Social Security. So all of these, you know, competing facts, and I totally agree with you that, you know, you can't win a culture war with facts. But we've just got a couple of minutes here. What should the metric for figuring out the best way of approaching immigration be? Should it be fairness and a moral argument that, you know, we have a big country, we should be a welcoming country, we should have borders that are as open as possible to as many people as possible? Is it an economic argument? Do we look to all of these employers who are clearly employing people from all over the world to do all sorts of things that it's reputed that Americans don't want to do, native-born Americans? I mean, is it an economic argument, a moral argument? How does it sit in your mind?
Is it a historic argument, right, given kind of what this country is and what this country has always been about? I think it's all of those things. But I think, though, it has to be a willingness for all of us to actually discuss the complexity of the issue. I would argue, too, that part of what's, and I alluded to this a few minutes ago, is also this questioning of why people are coming to begin with. Like, what else can we do to actually address that? And look, like, if people don't need, I mean, when I was arrested in Texas, this was when, you know, kind of the wave of unaccompanied minors from Central America was coming. This was during the Obama administration. It wasn't the crisis then, right? Actually, the Obama administration tried very hard to make sure that we didn't see those young people as refugees. So for me, this has been a bipartisan mess. Both parties have been responsible for where we're at. Trump, in many ways, just exploited it and took advantage of it. But it's going to take us, the American people, to be willing to really face what the issue is in its complexity and its fullness for us to really address what it is.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a filmmaker, and immigration rights activist. He is the founder of Define American, a nonprofit organization that explores the notion of identity in America. The new book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. He is speaking about the book at 7 o'clock tonight at the Church of the Redeemer in Baltimore. It's part of the Enoch Pratt Library's Writers Live series. It's been great meeting you. Your book is a terrific and compelling and provocative read, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got more information about the event tonight on our website, WIPR.org. We're also going to post a link to a video produced by the Marshall Project called We Are Witnesses that includes a commentary by Jose Antonio Vargas. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the nutrition diva Monica Reinagel joins me for a conversation about diets that are good for both individuals and for the planet. Plus, midday theater critic Jaywin Russick reviews Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the Hippodrome here in Baltimore. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Gift certificates are available tomorrow night at 6:30. They're offering a class on vegetarian Greek cuisine. We'll have more on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.